Unravel is the ABC's hit true crime podcast, where we investigate a new case each season. There are 6 seasons waiting for you to binge right now. That's 6 mysteries to unravel, including cold cases, disappearances, and a mysterious globe-trotting con woman. The Australian Podcast Awards have crowned Unravel Best True Crime Podcast twice. So if you haven't heard it yet, find out what you're missing out on. Follow the Unravel podcast now. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm just about to pull into Jim and Kath's. It's almost 8 o'clock in the morning in Wodonga. I woke up, I think, every hour on the hour last night, just worried about sleeping in past my alarm and all of the questions going around.
It wasn't just the alarm. Now I'm here on the other side of the country. I'm feeling the weight and pressure of a meeting that's been months in the making. I've come from southwest WA, 3,500 odd kilometres to Wodonga in Victoria to meet Chantelle's parents in person for the first time.
Good morning. Good morning. How's it going?
No. Jim and Kath's house is a regular 90s suburban home on a tree-lined street, about 10 minutes from the centre of Wodonga. They greet me warmly and we head inside to set up. Straight away, I notice the many family photos lining the walls, smiling faces that are evidence of regular lives which have been thrown into a very irregular situation. We walk into a cosy, carpeted lounge room.
Are they all your dolls?
Yes, I made them and dressed them.
Jim with his silvery white hair and cheeky grin, and Kath with her grey highlights and neat style. They could be anyone's parents of a certain age.
And then there's 2 Chinese dolls.
But sitting down to interview them about their missing daughter and granddaughter, I'm feeling the heaviness of what I'm asking. I'm Dominique Bayens, and this is episode 3, Down the Rabbit Hole. After we've checked everyone's warm enough, comfy enough, I start trying to get a sense of who Jim and Kath's little girl Chantelle was before she became a news headline. Jim describes Chantelle to me as his shining light, and I can see that when he talks about her. He's got a proud smile and a twinkle in his eye.
When she'd tell her own jokes and laugh before she finished telling you the joke, she was just hilarious.
Jim and Kath call her Shandy. She was the youngest of 3 children.
She'd come home with these sort of jokes, and one was, pass the honey, honey, pass the sugar, sugar, and pass the tea bags, bag. She'd go, she'd stretch it right out.
McDougall family life was full of adventure, and Chantelle was a water baby from the beginning. As they're remembering Chantelle's earlier life, Jim and Kath are laughing. One of them will start telling a story and the other one will join in to finish it.
She always was doing little plays at home with her sister from a very young age.
The family would be ushered into the upstairs lounge room where they'd be seated ready for the big performance.
Yes, you'd get an invite and she would get up and introduce themselves and what the show was, and they would do a Christmas play and they'd make it up.
Her love of performing didn't fade as Chantelle grew up.
Her interest as a teenager was all singing and dancing and acting and laughing, and I kept telling her one day, I'm going to be there when you're on the red carpet. But of course that hasn't happened.
Talking to Jim and Kath, I see Chantelle as a vivacious, playful young woman who didn't cause her parents much grief. But I also know that siblings sometimes get a very different view of each other. So when I'm back home in WA, I arrange a video hookup with her sister, Colleen Cook. Colleen was 4 years older than Chantelle, and I get the impression they were very different kinds of people.
Chantelle
was a bit of a Miss Popular. So she had a lot of friends and she was a little bit kind of Punky Brewster, just wanted to be fashionable and in with the crowd.
To be honest, I didn't really know who Punky Brewster was. I had to look it up. Punky Brewster was the hero of an 80s American sitcom. Very trendy, apparently, in her denim jacket covered in badges and patches. It's easy to read into this take of Chantel that her desire to be in with the crowd left her vulnerable down the track when the crowds she was getting involved in weren't just high school cliques. But then Colleen tells me other things that paint Chantel totally differently.
She used to come home quite a lot and telling us how she used to get kicked out of class. It's like, stop talking or you're going to have to go out and sit in the hallway. She would choose to go outside instead of being in class because she's like, I'm not going to stop talking, I'll go out.
So it sounds like she wasn't afraid to voice her opinions. She was a pretty outgoing girl.
Oh, yeah, she was very out there, very, you know, flamboyant.
This version of Chantel that Colleen paints, it seems louder and more rebellious than the picture I had in my mind. Reading through old newspaper articles where just about every headline screams cult, I imagined she must have been pretty impressionable. Not the strong-willed, I'll go out of class rather than stop talking, carefree girl. I'm curious if Jim and Kath saw any hints of what was to come. If she ever showed an interest in spirituality or religion.
She never really, in any way, thought about things like that. She's too busy having fun, I think.
Everything I've been hearing seems, if anything, overwhelmingly normal teenager stuff.
She was always chatting. She couldn't help but talk.
But that was all about to change. Chantel was just out of school, 17 and a half, when she told her folks she was off to the city.
Pack up and go to Melbourne, just as simple as that, she said.
And the plan, as she'd dreamed for years, was to try and make her name on the stage. From those living room performances to a big stage under lights.
Chantel never had any dreams of travelling the world or anything. She was just wanting to be an actress.
So they went round the Melbourne unis. But then Chantel didn't get a place in the course she was hoping for.
Then she, some reason or other, it all changed. She seemed to forgot about it. She never mentioned acting sort of again.
I think she would have been disappointed. So she was looking for something else.
As you might expect of an almost 18-year-old who's just left home for the first time, Jim and Kath weren't privy to the finer details of Chantel's life in the city. But they weren't overly worried. They'd already seen two children move out into the world and Chantel had family in Melbourne. She went to live with her granddad, and every week or so, she'd drop into her auntie Pauline's. In her 40s, working, raising a family and living the Melbourne life, Chantel would just hang out there sometimes.
She had her hair in a bob, just under her ears. And the thing about Chantel was her smile. Her face just lit up when she smiled and everybody felt that she was slim and energetic.
Pauline Taylor was at a busy time of life, but she was also into meditating and she'd frequently head to the local ashram on Saturday nights to slow down and take a moment from the busyness of life.
There were, you know, just friendly people who just were looking for some peace.
Pauline was saving for the great Australian dream to buy her own home. In the meantime, she was renting an older house with the washing machine outside, a tiny kitchen and a small backyard with just enough room for a little veggie patch. She put up an ad on the ashram notice board for a housemate for the spare room for a little extra cash. It's such a small, insignificant action, the sort of thing any of us would do without giving a moment's thought. But she would do anything to go back in time and take it down.
Yeah, okay. This is where I have to take a deep breath here on this stuff because, yeah, I'll just have another drink. So I put a notice up about having a spare room, and Simon Cookerman replied to the advertisement. That was fine. He was a clean-cut young man. He was working. He was training as a manager, trainee managership at one of the big supermarkets. He paid the bills and he was a personable young guy, and I thought, oh, he seems okay.
Just to be clear, this isn't Simon Cadwill, the guy you've been hearing about so far. Different Simon. Simon Cookerman moved in and everything was fine for a while. They each lived their own life. He seemed quiet, a little reserved perhaps, but a nice young man. Then things started changing.
After a while, he left his job. He said, oh, no, it wasn't really him. It wasn't really what he wanted to do with his life. And then little bits and pieces came out. I discovered that he had been married already and was separated from his wife.
Cookerman was still heading to the ashram where they'd first connected. But it seemed like he was starting to get into something else that was very different to Pauline.
He started bringing home these books. He asked me what I thought of them, and I said, oh, they're a bit outlandish, aren't they? So I'm a science-trained person, you know, even though I'm interested in meditation and all those kind of aspects of being, I always analyse things.
Pauline read some of the books Cookerman was offering her, and she was not impressed.
Because they were presenting various ideas as if they were reality. That's why I didn't like it. I didn't think that anyone could claim to know all this stuff. Nobody's got the answer as far as spiritual issues are concerned.
The book Pauline flicked through seemed to be talking about planes of existence, a truth.
And I didn't read any more of it. It was just garbage as far as I was concerned. It was gobbledygook. Somebody had sat there, you know, maybe they'd been tripping out one day on LSD and wrote this stuff and, you know, and that was what had come out of their brain. So I wasn't interested. I said, what do you think about them? And his response was, and I can remember it to this day, he said, it sounds right to me. And I thought, doesn't sound right to me.
Pauline wasn't going to be reaching for the sign-up sheet for whatever it was Simon Cookerman was into anytime soon. Then one day she came home from work and what she saw through her.
I came into the room and Simon had his arm around Chantelle's waist. They were looking at something on the desk. And as soon as I walked into the room, they quickly separated themselves. That was the first time, actually, that I really saw them together. I had no idea that Simon had taken a liking to Chantelle or vice versa. I really had no idea. I got a shock.
Cookerman was several years older than Chantelle, now unemployed. His reading matter was eccentric. She spoke to him about it, and as far as Pauline knew, that was the end of it. But it wasn't the end of Simon's odd behaviour.
Like one day he ate all the peanut butter in the cupboard. That was a bit odd. Odder even because it wasn't his peanut butter.
Anyone who's lived in a share house knows the sacred rule. Don't touch the stuff on your housemate's shelf.
He was sheepish about it. And it was, yeah, after that, he was just more introvert, I think, more introspective.
These odd moments were just scattered throughout life. Pauline was as busy as ever, Chantelle still popping in and out to catch up with the family. A couple of months later, Pauline bought her house and she and Cookerman went their separate ways. The next thing she knew, Chantelle had picked up a job nannying.
I knew that Simon Cookerman had introduced Chantelle to the person who she was babysitting for, a couple who had a child. I'll regret it till the day I die because then her life took a different track altogether.
Simon Cookerman had kept seeing Chantelle, and through him she had met Simon Cadwill. I know, too many Simons. Simon Cadwill, the one who would end up fathering her child, the one she would go missing with 10 years later.
In your mind, you might know that you're you're just one link in a chain of events that happened. And you have to say that to yourself. It's like the butterfly effect. And although you can think that intellectually in your mind, emotionally it doesn't help. It distresses me because I feel like although I was linking a chain of events, I was a pretty pivotal sort of link. I just know that putting that notice up in the ashram was a pivotal moment, obviously. It would be nice to go back and not put that sign up. So, but, you know, I can't do that. So it's the only way I can deal with it is to say to myself, I can't change the past. I was one event in a series of events, and that Shandy made her own choices and she had to live by them, as we all do.
Do you need a drink of water or anything?
Yeah, might have another one.
We're just going to take a little break.
What Pauline didn't know at the time was that this new Simon, Simon Cadwill, that Cookerman had connected Chantelle to, was the author of those strange books he'd been reading. And Chantelle was about to fall down the rabbit hole. By 1998, Chantelle had packed up her things and taken up that live-in nannying job for Simon Cadwill and his partner, a woman called Deborah Fleischer, looking after their baby son, Daniel. This was around the time when Donna, Chantelle's school friend with the bubblegum pink hair, had that run-in with Chantelle on Burke Street that would haunt her in the years to come. And Donna wasn't the only one to clock changes in Chantelle.
She came a bit more secretive.
Chantelle had only been in Melbourne a few months when Jim and Kath started to notice this difference in their bubbly youngest child.
Just she was a lot quieter. You ask her a few questions, you wouldn't get much of an answer at all.
She mentioned in a vague way to Kath that she was exploring some spiritual ideas, but nothing concrete or even remarkable.
She used to meditate. I can't imagine her meditating myself because she was such a chatter and a talker. I don't think she could keep her mouth closed. I got the feeling that she thought it's because that's what they do.
Here she was, her acting dream fallen by the wayside, nannying for this couple Jim and Kath had never laid eyes on.
And then she started telling us a little bit about his beliefs and things, and that really worried us.
Kath and Jim decide they need to meet him. So they drive the 3.5 hours to where Chantelle's living with them in Melbourne.
It was hard to find. It was like down a little tiny mountain track and it was off the edge of the road. You couldn't even drive into the property. It was a real secluded, hidden away place, which was pretty hard to get to. And so it sort of, what are they doing right up in here?
Jim and Kath pull up. They're not sure what to expect when they meet Simon and Deborah, but they did at least expect them to be there.
But they obviously got wind we were coming and they didn't want to front us, you know?
Instead, Chantelle comes outside to meet them on her own with a sweet one-year-old boy, Daniel, bottle in hand.
He was just running around playing and that while we were there.
They're not invited inside. They stay out the front. And they're not there long. But it's been long enough to make their worries bite harder. In person, the change is even more pronounced.
It was a bit of a shock to me that the way she spoke and she was just a different person, really, you know, already. She wasn't the same bubbly person that we remembered so much.
She seemed reserved.
What's going on? So I didn't know where to turn to find out anything, so I got the phone book and I looked up and I found the counsellor and I rang him.
Kath tells him what she knows and what she fears and about that gnawing worry.
And he said, you know, keep communicating. And that's what I tried to do all the time.
Kath started holding back. If she hit a wall when she asked a question, she backed off.
you could say I was afraid to question her too much or do anything because I didn't want her to not talk to me again.
So even at that point, it felt like if you stepped over a line that she could...
Close up.
Yeah. I always felt that all the time after she'd moved to Melbourne.
Jim and Kath describe it as being in no man's land, trying to work out what's going on, but totally in the dark. All the while, Chantelle, not quite 18, and living in the house of a man with strange beliefs, 18 years her senior. Unsure what to do, Kath and Jim kept their worries to themselves and focused on keeping those lines of communication open. As we've been talking, I've felt Jim and Kath getting tense. Kath occasionally has a nervous laugh, and Jim gets this faraway look in his eye. Hearing about all these people Chantelle was connecting with, the new things she was trying on for size, Donna's words come back to me, how everyone at that age has their own brand of trying to find yourself, and she thought this was just Chantelle's. It's easy with hindsight to read into all these red flags, the secrecy, the changes in her personality, but it's hard to tell where the line is between normal exploration and something more problematic. God knows I did my fair share of stupid stuff when I was younger. But then in late 1998, Jim was at home when he got a call from Chantelle. She'd packed her bags and was off, like so many other young people, idealistic and looking for adventure.
Just on her own, never even had a phone, had nothing, just her and a case and away she went. She was going to save the world. But she was that bloody game as Ned Kelly, you know?
Before she headed off, she came home for a final McDougal Christmas. A big do where, as Jim puts it, everyone would eat too much, drink too much and play cricket. She bounced around for the next year, first to Central Australia, then Perth, then the UK. It was a relief for Jim and Kath. They thought Chantelle had left behind that strange nannying situation. What they didn't know was she was actually being drawn further in by Simon. By late 1999, Chantelle was back in the country after returning from the UK. She was in Perth, on the other side of the country to her folks. And a call came that made Jim realise that perhaps Chantelle hadn't made the clean break they'd hoped from Simon Cadwell. She was 19 and she wanted her dad's advice. She was trying to get Simon back in the country. He'd been in the UK alongside Chantelle. Jim and Kath had had no idea.
There was talk that Chantelle, she'd had to falsify documents to get him back into the country.
Yeah, I did a double take here too. Falsify documents? As in forgery? Why would Simon need to lie? And why was Chantelle the one helping him? She was apparently just the nanny. Well, ex-nanny as far as Jim and Kath knew. Jim wasn't sure what exactly Chantelle was being asked to do, but he knew something wasn't right if she was being asked to commit fraud to get this man back into Australia.
She said, I don't know if I should do this. I said, well, you shouldn't really do it. But anyway, she must have done it because he got back into the country.
I don't know whether Chantelle did forge paperwork to get Simon Cadwell back into Australia, but I can confirm that she did help with his visa. And he did get back into the country. Simon moved in with Chantelle, Deborah Fleischer, and their now 3-year-old son, Daniel, along with a woman called Justine.
He had Chantelle in one bedroom and Deb in another bedroom and Justine in another bedroom and poor old Tony popping out in the tent in the backyard.
I'm going to take a moment here because there's a bit going on. It's the year 2000 and there are three women all in different bedrooms. Chantelle, the mum she's apparently still nannying for after all, and this new woman, Justine Smith. Justine Smith had connected with them through a spiritual group and over a few years became one of their inner circle, travelling and living with Simon, just like Chantelle. And a couple of years later, Tony Popich, who sold Jodie McDonald her bronze horse statue and who would eventually disappear along with Chantelle, Leela and Simon, would turn up after Deborah Fleischer left. He'd been living a nomadic lifestyle and being drawn into the same spiritual teachings as the others. I can see why Jim and Kath were worried. Then, in early 2001, came another call. One that would make it a whole lot harder to get Chantelle away.
Oh, she rang up and said, oh, I'm having a baby, just like that. And I was quite taken back for a minute.
It takes a moment for Kath to integrate what she's just heard.
But then I was excited.
A grandchild. Chantelle was 20. Kath hangs up and calls out to Jim.
Kath would have told me probably 10 seconds after she put the phone down. I didn't know that the relationship, I was sort of, who's the father sort of thing, you know, what the first thing your dad said, I'm going to go and kill him, you know. Yeah, I should have.
It's a lot to take in. Chantelle's pregnant to a man they didn't even realise she was in a relationship with, who's her employer and 18 years older with some strange beliefs, who they've still never met. Whatever they think of this man, it looks like he and Chantelle are about to become permanently linked. It's October 2001, a warm, sunny spring day, and Kath gets off a plane. It's her first time in Perth and she's not packed light.
I'd come over with my case full of all these things, clothes and things I'd made, and I brought them all over in my case. The case was that heavy I could barely lift it.
6 weeks ago, Chantelle gave birth to a little baby girl, Leela, and Kath's there to meet her.
Chantelle came up and got me in her car. We went down to the house and then I got a cuddle and it was just lovely. It was just makes me feel all warm and fuzzy thinking about it.
Kath was smitten with Leela. Leela was a little unsettled to sleep, but had that same thick head of hair Chantelle had had.
And how did Chantelle seem at that time?
Quite excited about it, but I think, like all new mums, a bit daunted by it all. And she was also looking after Daniel again at the same time.
Listening to Kath, I feel like I could be hearing any doting grandma talk about meeting their grandchild for the first time. I have to remind myself just how unusual this situation was that Kath was walking into. Chantelle has just given birth to the child of a man she'd been nannying for and was in fact still caring for his other child to another woman. Deborah Fleischer wasn't around anymore. She'd packed up and left a short time after Simon returned from the UK and was having relationships with all three women in that Floriate house. She came back for Daniel in about 6 months. Then, of course, Chantelle got pregnant and Leela arrived. Justine Smith was still in the house, Tony soon to move into the tent in the backyard. And at the centre of this web, Simon Cadwill. I really wanted to speak with these other women, but they've been really hard to find, and at least one of them doesn't want to talk. Arriving in the Floriate house in Perth, it wasn't just Kath's first time meeting Leela. It was also the first time she'd laid eyes on Simon.
He was very, very tall, always tidy, quite well groomed.
What do you remember of that first meeting with him?
Oh boy, he's weird. That's all I could think. Because he asked me what planet I was from and there's a better life there on the astroplane and all this sort of stuff. And I was just really taken back because I thought, what are you talking about?
Other than these bizarre grillings, Simon didn't have much to do with Kath. Just a, hey, how's it going as they passed in the kitchen. Leela didn't capture much of his attention either.
He didn't seem to come in and pick her up or anything like that. He'd just come in and sort of look at the baby and go, hello, sort of thing, to the baby and go off again.
My heart breaks a little bit for Chantel here. A young first-time mum, looking after Simon's other child at the same time, and Simon apparently disinterested in any of it. It fits with what Diane told me, though, how Chantel was told she could have Leela, but he wouldn't be helping. It would be all on her. It's pretty brutal. There's this other thing as well. I know I've spent a lot of time wondering about it, and Jim and Kath couldn't really make sense of it either.
Leela McDougall, that was it.
Never took Simon's name on, just stayed with Chantel's name. So there's no father's name on the birth certificate. So
why was that?
That's his way he was of being secretive, I guess, you know.
10 days later, Kath said goodbye and headed back to Victoria. They talk regularly on the phone, and Kath would send over parcels filled with her homemade clothes.
You must have been one of the best-dressed kids in the area.
After 4 years, Leela had provided a link again to their daughter. It felt like maybe there was a little more light through the door to Chantel's life. Like maybe things might settle into some sort of normal.
She was talking to us more and telling us a few more things. I felt like it was a bit more like a normal relationship and family type situation, but yeah, little did we know. It sort of wasn't.
Because just as Kath had reconnected with Chantel, she was about to be whisked even further away. After speaking to Jim and Kath, I feel like I understand more how Chantel came to be tied up with Simon. I keep thinking of that analogy of tree roots that over years become so intertwined that it's almost impossible to pull them apart. While I'm there, Kath shows me the boxes of photos of Chantel she stored away. And as we sift through them, there's this one of a brunette woman at a pub holding a baby. Sitting next to her, wearing a party hat, is Leela McDougall. It's got a caption scribbled on the back with a name. Tracy. It's weeks later I manage to find who this Tracy is. And what she tells me makes me second guess this whole picture I've been building of what happened. I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, the NANUP 4. Please subscribe so you get every episode as they drop. And leave a review wherever you're listening. It really helps others find us. If you can add to this story or have information you think might be important, please get in touch. This season of Expanse was developed in collaboration with ABC's Regional WA team on Wudandi and Bibbulmun country. Sound design is by Grant Walter, who is also a producer, along with Megan Woods, with additional production and research by Jessica Hinchliffe, Kate Stevens and Louise Mylan. Our supervising producer is Pia Wursu. Executive producer is Blythe Moore.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.